And you're listening to Upfront on KPFA. I'm Antonia Yuhas.
Our philosophy, possibly speak tongues. Beat drums, Abyssinian Street Baptist, Baptist and violinist. From the beginning, my practice extending across the atlas. I begat this, flipping in together on the dirty mattress. You can't match this, rapper slash actress. More powerful than two Cleopatras. Bomb graffiti on the tomb of Nefertiti.
That magic was Everything is Everything from The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. This marks the 20-year anniversary since the album was released. It was groundbreaking in every sense of the word. It has sold over 19 million copies, is often cited by music critics as one of the most important recordings in modern history, has inspired artists from Beyoncé to Nicki Minaj, and was recently included in the National Recording Registry of the Library of Congress. It is also the subject of the latest book of our guest, Joan Morgan. The book She Begat This, 20 Years of the Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, is itself a magically written document, weaving music, culture, poetry, power, critique, and love into a tightly written 155 pages. I am extremely happy to have the opportunity to welcome Joan Morgan with us here today.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
In addition to this interview, you can listen to Joan live tonight in Oakland. She's speaking at 7:30 at the First Congregational Church. Tickets are $12 in advance and $15 at the door. The event is a fundraiser for KPFA, and you can learn more on our website at kpfa.org. But at the end of this half hour, you will have a special offer for our listeners, two pairs of free tickets. Our guest, Joan Morgan, is a feminist, a hip-hop journalist, and an award-winning author who coined the term hip-hop feminism with her first book, When Chickenheads Come Home to Roost. She's taught at Duke, Stanford, and the New School. She began a career in journalism as a freelance writer for The Village Voice, was executive editor of Essence Magazine, and has written for Spin, Vibe, Giant, and many others. We were just listening to Hill's words, but I'd like to ask you to read some of your own, reading from a passage of your latest book.
Sure. This was in part due to the utter uniqueness of Hill's components. Black, female, Ivy Leaguer, a Columbia University English major, blessed with a broad literary arsenal that simultaneously reflected her dexterity as a wordsmith and her acute understanding of the latent but deadly power in the economy of words. Lauryn was nice with hers. She had rhyme schemes that could stalk a lyrical adversary with panther-like precision. With a sing-song playfulness, she could engage her silky alto and disarm anyone who made the mistake of taking her too lightly, then spit a death blow with the percussiveness of machine gun rounds or metronomic machete swings, depending on her mood.
I love the power of those words. Can you talk about that passage and the decision to write this book for the 20-year anniversary of the release of the album?
So this actually was not my idea. I can't take credit for that. Atria contacted my agent and asked, said that they were interested in doing exactly this, having a book that commemorated the 20th anniversary of the album. And my they asked if I would be interested. I was actually planning on finishing my dissertation during that period of time. So the plan to sort of put a pause on it and write the book was completely unexpected. However, when I thought about it, I usually, whether it is, if it's a large writing project, if it's a book, if it's a significant kind of article, I generally won't do it if I feel like someone else can do it, you know, and someone would do it in that I don't have anything new to add to the conversation. And when I thought about the ability to write about this album and I thought about the scholar in me, it was very much like, wow, this album drops at the end of the 20th century. Pre-social media, pre-digital age, at a time when we still are, black people are still calling Bill Clinton the first black president. We haven't had a black president yet. And hip-hop is in a very particular moment in being both part of, in the midst of the golden age, and also struck with an incredible amount of violence. For myself, women are really starting to wrestle with the misogyny and how do I continue to love a music and that so often lyrically seems as if it doesn't love me back. And so I wanted to really use that periodization of being at closing the 20th century and being 18 years into another century. And I thought that the album, and really looking at the cultural and political and social forces that it was sort of born in, was just a great lens. And these books tend to be very... there's a series called 33 and a Third, and they often analyze. They'll take an iconic album, and the approach to it can be very sort of music journalist, kind of music geek, where you go track by track, and you know, you track down producers, and they want to know what's happening in the studio. I've never written about music like that. I use music to write about culture, and I use culture to write about Black people, as specifically Black women. And Lauren was so significant in all of those boxes, and this album was so significant that I felt like it was a perfect opportunity. And I also wanted the opportunity to just write a music, a piece of music criticism that featured 98% female cultural critics. We often get plus one into projects that are written by the guys where we represent the female voice. And I felt that the writers who and DJs and kind of cultural authorities that are included in the book were not only there and could tell the story perfectly well without being plus one'd into someone else's story, but we were also architects of the story. So
I'm really interested in hearing you talk more about hip-hop journalism and being a hip-hop feminist, a term you coined, and what it was like to be a journalist during that time and to be a journalist writing about these emerging artists like Lauryn Hill.
So, you know, my favorite story about discovering that I was a hip-hop journalist, no one I knew who was writing at the time in terms of the people that would consider themselves or people consider foundational sort of hip-hop journalists now as myself, it really wasn't what we were doing. I remember being out with Scott Pilson Bryan and Kevin Powell and being downtown, and I think we were on our way to Sticky Mike's, and some kid just came up and recognized us, I don't even know how, and was like, oh my God, are you so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so? And we're like, yeah. And he said, I want to do what you want to do. I want to do what you do. I want to be a hip-hop journalist. And we all kind of, you know, we engaged him in conversation and told he wanted to know what we read. And all of us said Baldwin. And, you know, I think all of us said Toni Morrison. And he left and we were like, what the bleep is a hip-hop journalist? Like, we didn't really understand. We were writers, first and foremost, and all of us, writers who were very much interested in writing about culture through the lens of popular culture, and all of us loved hip-hop. We didn't realize that we were creating an actual new form of journalism at the time, and I think that we had to grow into that. Understanding that we created something and that it means something and it's an intervention and it has a certain kind of power. But, you know, to give people some perspective, hip-hop feminism didn't exist. Hip-hop studies didn't exist in universities. You couldn't go into a university and say, I want to do a PhD in hip-hop studies, or I'm applying hip-hop studies to my education degree. Like, we were really busy sort of... you know, I came up, I'm in grad school now at NYU, and I always tell people my original cohort are my fellow hip-hop journalists. Like, I came up with Jeff Chang. I came up with Scott Pilson Bryan. I came up with Kevin Powell. I came up with Kierna Mayo, Dream Hampton. And these are the people who we were our own bar. We were fiercely competitive with each other and extremely supportive of each other at the same time. So, like, you know, other people write and they're concerned now about, like, hits and likes. I'm concern back then with, like, do those peers think my piece is dope? Or conversely, did I miss something that my peers are just going to go in on? And I have to be like, damn, I really dropped the ball there. And so it was much smaller. It was really intimate. We took everything really, really, really seriously that I don't, looking back now, I'm like, there could have been some levity. there really could have been some levity there. But I think that all of us were very clear that hip-hop was important and that hip-hop was going to be documented and that it should be documented by people who look like the people who produce it. So,
were your cohorts feminists?
Yeah, nah. No. I mean, I wasn't really a feminist at that point. I was growing into my feminism, and I wouldn't say that they weren't. I think that it took the guys longer to sign on. And then I think, like, you know, myself, people like Kierna and myself were just trying to figure it out. And will this label, if I take this label, how do I also include hip hop in that? Because I'm not giving that up. But no, we weren't. I think now when, you know, it's a generation later, and there are women who come to hip hop and write very clearly from the position of being feminists who write about hip hop, or hip hop feminists who write about music and culture, whatever else they write about. We were creating that language, but we weren't creating it with this. We were creating language that described a reality that we were living. We weren't like living a reality and then saying this is the political platform that we are using to explain ourselves. We were really just trying to figure ourselves out.
Mm-hmm. And how has that changed to today? So you were forging this really new territory, defining new terms. You know, what do you think is the state of hip-hop journalism today, hip-hop feminism, feminist journalism?
You know, I mean, it's very different. Like, you know, I remember the first time somebody sent me their dissertation and said it was on, well, asked if they could send me a dissertation and asked if they could send it because they were doing it on hip-hop feminism. And I was like, wait, you can study this in school? Like, I just didn't really understand or know how important what we were creating was and how it would go on to have lives that are much further and along from us. I think that hip hop journalism, I don't know. I mean, I think what we see now are a lot of think pieces. And because of the democratization sort of these spaces, you don't have to be published by a magazine or a newspaper. You can kind of write a really long Facebook post that gets picked up by The Root or The Griot. And I think in some ways, having more voices is a great thing. And in many ways, I feel like it is been a really bad thing in many ways. I became a strong writer because I worked with really strong editors. I had to rewrite. I had that cohort that I discussed earlier. I had a great sense of accountability. Because hip hop was so small, it was very easy to be writing about somebody and being at a party with them 3 days later after it dropped. You have a different kind of accountability when you know that your subject matter can step to you in a public place and want to talk about what you wrote. I generally think that the idea of the on-demand think piece is, does a disservice to cultural criticism. There's a way that you have to sit with culture, and you also have to be able to observe what the culture's response is and that takes a little bit of time. And generally, it takes time to sit with art and just think about what this means.
Our guest is Joan Morgan. She is the author of She Begat This, The 20 Years of the Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. She is speaking tonight at 7:30 p.m. at the First Congregational Church. So one of the things that I loved in reading this book was the treatment, the discussion of Lauryn Hill, using your beautiful writing to talk about her beautiful writing and the power of beautiful writing, which I think is the, you know, sort of also in the power of what you were saying, having the time to learn a craft and deliver the craft and to see writing and reporting and thinking as art. And can you talk about Lauryn Hill as the writer?
So my love affair with El Boogie, and I think El Boogie is a very different incarnation creatively than Ms. Hill. I think Ms. Hill is a different demarcation in terms of her creative process and the way that she thinks about herself and her engagement with her audience. But my initial engagement with El Boogie in the Fugees and then culminating in my love for Lauren first and foremost comes as an MC. I think a lot of people can sing, and the culture is blessed with a lot of great singers. So I don't take anything away from her singing voice. But as an MC, I think she is singular. I think she is one of the best to ever do it. And I'm not saying one of the best female MCs. I'm saying in terms of the genre, one of the best MCs hip hop has produced, hands down. And part of that was just, I would just be so blown away at that, like, Ivy League mind of her and the mind of her and the way that she would turn a phrase. I mean, Nina Simone defecating on your microphone, like, what? What? She wasn't, you know, the end of the 90s also was the, we're starting to see the birth of reality TV, right? So the country enters into this period of a kind of anti-intellectualism where, you start to hear language like too academic or not smart enough. And smart people are trying to pretend that they're not smart. And what I really, and you know, and hip hop has, Akiba Solomon talks about this in the book, has middle class people, upper middle class people trying to pretend that they don't have any money. It's like very weird, right? And Lauren just steps so comfortably into all of who she is. She makes no apology for her talent, her brains, her vocabulary. And she just sort of, you know, she spits and, if you can't, you don't know what she's saying, get a dictionary. People used to do that back in the day. But she doesn't dumb it down, ever. And because of that, she makes her audience rise to another level. And I've always respected that about her as a writer. And as a writer and somebody that cares about language and craft, I can always tell when somebody has really gone in and, like, worked it. You know what I mean? Who probably could have settled for something much simpler, but went, I just want to push a little bit harder. I know when someone is making the effort to make the words sing, and I feel like she showed up and did that over and over and over again. As an MC, hands down, she's the strongest Fuji. And like I said, I think the place that her lyrical prowess is, like, carved in hip-hop history is undeniable.
Are there songs from Miss Education of Lauryn Hill that you think are the best examples of this?
Yeah, I mean, for me, you know, a lot of, so people had two reactions. I think people are playing the album a lot now in embrace of the 20th anniversary. And then I talked to a lot of people who love the album and said they love the album and talked about where they were when it came out, what was going on with their lives. But when I asked them what they, if they still listen to it in constant rotation, the answer was no. It was really more like a really good friend from high school or college that you just love when the two of you show up and you're in the same place, but you don't kick it with each other day to day that way anymore. But it still occupies a very special place in your history and your heart. What people said, though, I said, well, what do you listen to when you reach back and you do listen to it? For me, that's Lost Ones, and it's because I always, anything that she's rhyming on is going to be the stronger cut for me. And then for other people, it was, the second was Zion, and then the third was always X Factor, and then Nothing Really Matters. And those seem to be the, and then after that, maybe Everything is Everything, but those seem to be the cuts that people have in their lives in a very present kind of way. And for me, in terms of the way she still resonates in kind of my political work, my feminist work, is that line, like, who, tell me my personal life, my love life, my relationship life. Tell me, who do I have to be to get some reciprocity? Mm-hmm. I think is a question that women, particularly Black women, are consistently asking in our relationships, in our political work, in the ways that we show up. I mean, Black Lives Matter is an amazing movement, but do we still really have to hashtag say her name because you're not, like, paying attention attention to the ways that this violence just takes us out. And it's like, who do we have to be to get back what we give you? And that lyric so often comes to mind.
So much of the power of what Hill brought in her writing was political and reflecting a politics of the time that often gets lost when people remember, this album. And you help us remember that in the book. Can you talk about this period of time that gave birth to Hill and then Hill delivered to us through her writing?
So it's broad, right? So one of the things I did in researching the book was really pay a lot of attention to what was happening at the end of the 1990s. We're living in a pre-9/11 world. We certainly are living not in the madness of the Trump era, but we're also living at a time where people really legitimately do not think we'll ever have a black president. We're living at a time where we don't really, people like the Clintons, you know, people voted for the Clintons. Bill Clinton was one of the first, Jesse Jackson was probably the first president, presidential candidate I voted for. And then the next time I voted, it was for a Clinton. And I was really excited about Bill. I met him in the White House. The Clintons are charming, larger than life, problematic figures, but you know, by and large, black folk really like them. And Lauren, for me, was writing an album that is so obviously about love. It's disappointments, it's promises. And in 2018, one of the most common hashtags we have is hashtag Black Love. Like the need to see it on screen, see it in real life, see it validated. And I'm saying there's, you know, what happened between there? This album about a broken heart that exists in a particular political climate. Bill Clinton is also the president that comes closest to being impeached, right? Mm-hmm. Over an affair, which we can't even imagine now in the Trump era. And I, you know, he's in the midst of a really serious love triangle. So's Lauren. And so I wanted to just compare what are those realities. And what I realized is that many of the, we think about the late 90s as the waiting to exhale era, and 2018 just feels more like the waiting and waiting era. And when I looked back at the Clinton's policies, welfare to work, the drug laws, how devastating and how destabilizing they were, particularly to black women in terms of what they would do to destabilizing our families, actually absenting black men from our communities, that the realities for some of the reason that this album still resonates so much in terms of like love and loss and wanting, those political realities instituted by the Clintons were really responsible in many ways for a lot of this, the reason that this album still resonate along with her artistry. You know, I have the privilege of traveling in a really warm audience is how much love still exists and goodwill exists for Lauryn Hill, the artist. And I often wish that I could just record it or package it or, you know, package it up, tie it in a bow and deliver it to her so she could open it. It's really beautiful and it's really expansive. And I just hope that she's receiving it in some way or another.
Thanks for being with us, Joan.
Thank you.
Yo, we about to get
the book, She Begat This, 20 Years of the Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, the incredible, brilliant author Joan Morgan. She is speaking tonight at 7:30 p.m. at First Congregational Church of Oakland. That's 2501 Harrison Street. We have two pairs of free tickets for you, our KPFA listeners. If you call now at 510-848-4425, callers 3 and 7 win a pair of tickets each. That's 510-848-4425.